came out tonight deserves not to have a final exam for this course. I've thought of many things in the Jewish problem, but never a snow in the Jewish problem. And these Monday nights, the last few weeks, have seemed doomed by the snow. In any case, we're talking tonight about wisdom, conventional and unconventional. And I'd like to begin a little bit in left field and make my way slowly to the wisdom literature. I'll get there. Have faith. But the place to begin, I think, is with cannon. Not the military hardware, which is so expensive, but with a cannon with a single N, the cannon of the Bible. One of the things I find hardest to convince students of is the nature of what we call the Bible or Holy Scriptures. It's bound, whatever the Bible, the Christian Bible, the Jewish Bible, bound in a single buckram cover. It's got a title. It's assumed to be a single thing. And though different books have different names, the assumption is that somehow the material that's inside these covers is all of one literary type, or rather, all of one level of inspiration. It all represents the Word of God, or the will of God, or what biblical man believed to be the inspired speech revealed to him through Moses and through the prophets. Now, of course, the existence of a biblical canon, or final edition. The word canon comes from a Greek word that was taken over by the Latin church fathers in the 3rd century. They used it to define the standard edition. It means measure. But long before there was an edited Bible as such, there were separate scrolls. And these scrolls circulated separately, and each had its own history. And sometimes some of this history is relatively complex. Sometimes two books were simply stitched together, as two pieces of parchment were stitched together. There's a very clear stitching at the end of the 40th chapter of Isaiah when the words of a man, a prophet who could not have lived within 3 centuries of the time of Isaiah, suddenly begin to appear. But more than this, biblical man never had a Bible. He had no Holy Scriptures. He had no volume which he believed to be fully inspired. If he had seen some of our modern fundamentalists do what they do with Bibles, that put it up on the back, you know, on the spine, and let the leaves fall open and put their finger on the text and read the text as God's prophecy for them for that day, or if they would have heard a modern minister or rabbi preaching from his pulpit, quoting from Proverbs or Job or Ecclesiastes as if this were the Word of God, they wouldn't have known what was happening. They had no Bible, which is not to say they did not have a sacred literature. They did. They had laws which they presumed to be revealed. They had an early history. In fact, by exilic times, they had several histories. Several sacred histories, but they had no Bible as such. And our tradition has been wiser than the English tradition, the Latin tradition, in talking of the Bible, not using the word Bible, which means simply Biblia, but in using an acronym, the word Tanakh, T-N-Chaf, Tuf-Nun-Chaf, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. An acronym is a word made up, like USA, of the first letters of subsequent words in a phrase. Torah refers to the 5 books of Moses. Nevi'im means prophets and refers not only to the 15 prophets we know by name in the Bible, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets, but to the Deuteronomic histories, the prophetic histories of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And the Kaf refers to Ketuvim, which means simply the writings. And the writings are of a varied lot: Psalms, Proverbs, Job, Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, Daniel, and then the priestly histories, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles. By using this word Tanakh, our tradition was trying to remind us that each of these separate parts is assumed to be of a different degree of authority. It has its own literary and cultural history among biblical Jews and for our people, and it was used differently within the tradition. For example, in our services to this day, we read regularly, systematically, annually, the Torah. In the traditional synagogue, every word, every verse of the Torah is read through in the course of a given year. In ancient Palestine, every word was read through in the course of 3 years. But the difference is minimal. The important thing is that the systematic reading of the Torah has been part of the liturgy, the worship, the learning of our people for a long, long time. Neither of the other sections were read systematically. There is no tradition among Jews of reading from the prophets in a kind of cyclical way, beginning with Isaiah and ending with Malachi. There's no tradition of reading systematically through any of the books or the whole version of the Holy Writings. As a matter of fact, the additional reading, the Haftarah, which is used in the traditional synagogue, is taken traditionally only from the prophets and not from the Holy Writings. Only on some of the very special holidays do we read from the third section, which suggests what is in fact true, that this is primary, this is of a second level, and this is of a third level. If I were to put modern terms on these materials, this represented to the traditional Jew, to the biblical Jew, the Word of God. This represented the interpretation of the Word of God, and this represented inspired literary activity. We might almost call secular literature, except the word secular has no meaning in this context. Literature by men rather than by God, of man's inspiration rather than of God's revelation. And each of these three bodies of literature has had its own very special history. The Torah is composed primarily of law. Its history is that it represents largely oracular law, laws which were associated with priests and shrine, believed to have been revealed directly. The controlling myth is that of Sinai, when Moses receives the commandments. And added to this is an early history of our people. But all of it is assumed to be revealed, and it is certainly assumed to be authoritative, and it is basic Judaism. It was read publicly, we know, systematically for the first time in the middle of the 5th pre-Christian century, and probably within a century after that. The scroll called the Torah becomes normative. That is, we have a scroll of Torah very much like the scroll we have today. So the scroll of the Torah goes back certainly 2,500 years, possibly a century or two more. The various collections of the prophets began to be set down in the 6th, 5th, 4th centuries. They were certainly collected in their present form by the end of the Persian period, by about the time that Alexander the Great begins to assert his authority over the Middle East at the end of the 4th pre-Christian century. And we've had a prophetic codex or scroll ever since that time. Separate scrolls, but authorized. And the reading from Torah and prophets, Torah and Nevi'im, which is referred to constantly in Hellenistic Jewish literature, was a practice in the synagogue and in the temple from the end of Persian times down to our time. The history of the Holy Writings is much different. The final canon of the writings canonization does not take place till the second century of the Common Era, at least 500 years after the canonization of the prophetic books. That is not to say that there were not that one or another of these books might not have been edited in its present form long before that. It is simply to say that we have records in Tanakh literature of the rabbis still debating early in the second century whether or not Song of Songs, whether or not Proverbs, whether or not Ecclesiastes should be included in the biblical canon. So up to that point, they are still debating
what is a scriptural text and what is not a scriptural text as far as material in this third section is concerned. We know by name of books which were thought of as possibilities for inclusion which were not included. One or two of these appear in the collection known as the Apocrypha, which is the collection of books often printed by the Roman Catholic Church, along with the New Testament, the Tanakh, as part of the Bible. It's a collection of largely Hebraic materials, which for one reason or another the Jews decided not to include in the biblical canon. The Wisdom of Ben Sirach, often called Ecclesiasticus, which is the school textbook of a rhetor, of a teacher in Jerusalem early in the second pre-Christian century, who taught the sons of the upper class, it was the university school or the Hawkins school of the day, is included in the Apocrypha. It was thought as a possibility for inclusion in the biblical canon and was not included, apparently largely because the book of Proverbs, which it resembles greatly, was included. It's, by the way, the source of the very famous Let Us Now Praise Famous Men and Our Fathers Who Begat It, which is, begins in chapter 40 of Ben Sirach. Now, all of this is simply to suggest to you that the Bible is a library, the library of materials which biblical man, and this is after all that's important, the biblical man accepted with varying degrees of reverence and of authority. The Torah was the constitution of the post-exilic Jewish state. Judea was ruled by the Torah. And Torah law became the constitution of Jewish communities throughout the world. The prophetic materials in the Nevi'im represented the interpretation by Jews of how God revealed himself through history. When it explained the punishment of the Jews, because people had sinned against the covenant, they explained security and good rainfall and fertility and prosperity when the people had obeyed the will of God. They wrote the histories to make all this very clear, and they included the prophetic texts in which God had made this clear for man. The writings themselves make no attempt at being normative, that is, at being theologically orthodox. They include a wide range of materials, some purely secular in our modern sense, like the Song of Songs, which, however much it has been interpreted by synagogue and by church, is in origin nothing more than a collection of Oriental marriage songs, which were originally part and parcel of wedding ceremonies in those ancient times. It includes psalms, some of which are cultic, some of which are personal, some of which are didactic, some of which are historic, some of which come from pre-exilic times, some of which come from post-exilic times. It includes the book of Ecclesiastes, of which I'm going to talk later, which is a book of despair, an old man tired of the struggle, sort of given up on life. Someone once called it the musings of an old professor. And it certainly, in its text, is a book which runs counter to all of the assumptions of God's providence, that God rewards goodness and punishes wickedness, that are part and parcel of the rest of the material. Now, the literature that I want to talk about tonight is found largely in this third section. It is not deemed, it was not deemed to be authoritative. It was not deemed to be normative. It makes no attempt to declare or set out new Torah law. It's a kind of literature which we call wisdom literature. Now, wisdom is not here used as a pejorative word, and obviously, suggesting everything else in the Bible is foolish, and this is the only wise literature. The word wisdom is a word which scholars use because it is used of a whole variety of literatures of the first millennium before the Common Era. That is, from about 1200 B.C. to about 200 B.C., wisdom literature is a common form of learning, of knowledge, shared by Egypt, shared by Palestine, and shared to a certain degree by the cultures of Babylonia and Assyria. It's a common form of literature familiar to all the peoples of the ancient Middle East. It's a kind of literature which operates with a series of shared assumptions. And I'd like, before we get into specifics, to try and make these clear to you. The assumptions are that life is essentially confusing. And that if we try and understand life only with common sense, only with, from our own private experience, we're going to fall over ourselves, all over ourselves. Man is limited. Man's abilities are limited. Man's experience is limited. Man will fail if he does not recognize certain basic truths. And what are these? The first truth, and the most basic one, is that there is order within the confusion, which is the apparent reality of life. And behind all the confusions of the weather, the confusions of natural disasters, the confusions of human life, there's a kind of cosmic order, there's a natural order, and there's an appropriate order for the government of human societies and for the discipline of every human being. Order is the basic but hard-to-find principle, which is structurally part and parcel of life itself. And man, insofar as he can order his life, make his life fit exactly the order of the world, will find that his life has stability, it has value, it has purpose, it has meaning. If his life is disorderly, undisciplined, if he fails to perceive the cosmic order, the natural order, and to live in accordance with it, he will always be frustrated because some obstacle will always be in his path. Wisdom is that library of information, that inheritance of knowledge, which the wise men have discerned largely through, we think, inspiration. That is, largely they've had a sense that suddenly a new insight came to them, that it isn't simply common sense. That understanding of the universe, which they have won, and which they are willing, as best they can, to pass on to those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. In other words, wisdom is the inherited philosophy of the race, the inherited definition of what virtue consists of. It is a series of very pragmatic, very practical, very specific pieces of advice, adages, proverbs, maxims, dialogue, folk wisdom, all kinds of things, which suggest to you and to me the nature of the universe, the nature of man, the nature of the good life. This is the knowledge that was taught in the schools. The schools, remember, now were only for the upper classes, first for the very wealthy, the princes, the powerful, the establishment people. The word chokhmah in Hebrew, wisdom, begins by meaning the ability to handle a specific task. A chacham may be the craftsman who produces a magnificent vase or a magnificent cabinet. But Salel is called a chacham because he produces the utensils, the golden utensils, which are basic to the cult. Chokhmah becomes the ability of any man to do something well. The farmer to be a good agriculturalist. The counselor to be a good counselor to the king. It is the requirement that any man in authority must have, for only with wisdom can he properly order the society for which he is responsible. And the basic assumption, philosophic assumption, within this whole structure is not only that there's a principle of order which can be discerned, which some men have discerned and you would be wise to accept, but that if you obey these good counsels, if you are good, good will happen to you. The man who follows the laws of painting, or the laws of cabinet making, or the laws of architecture, must produce a good building. The man who follows the laws of life, the laws of human relationships, must produce a good life. The good life, the good thing, are good in themselves. The good man causes good to happen to himself, and he causes good to happen to his community. His community is the better for him because he brings order to it. First, the accomplishment of his own orderly life, the example. Next, the accomplishment that he has in relationships to others, those who are particularly under his authority. The Greeks have a word called paideia. Paideia means moral instruction, it means education, it means discipline. It means very much what the Hebrew word musar meant in the medieval text. Now, paideia and chokhmah are very much one and the same thing, structurally. The goals of what a gentleman must be are not always defined in the same way. But they operate on the same assumptions. To be good, to do good, then you must succeed. If you are good, that is, if you are wise, good will happen to you. Folly is the great enemy. And folly may be shrewdness. Folly may be following your own wisdom against the larger depository of wisdom, against what mankind knows wisdom to be. Now, wisdom literature has been found, as I suggested to you, among all the peoples of the ancient Middle East. As a matter of fact, two of the chapters in the book of Proverbs we know are directly parallel to some material which has been found from one of the pharaohs of the 19th dynasty. Sentence by sentence, you can parallel this kind of wisdom. And we know that men who were deemed to be hachamim, wise men, maskilim, went from court to court. Daniel, the Jew, a wise man, that is a master of wisdom, was at the court of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian. Lemuel, who according to the Bible is the author of the last chapter of Proverbs, is a non-Jew. Job is a non-Jew. These are wise men according to the biblical definition. Wisdom was something which operates independently of the national religion. It does not mean that in each community, those who framed the wisdom didn't use the terms familiar to them. Jews spoke of Torah. Others might have spoken their own scripture. But the important thing is that it is a kind of international vision. It's a national assumption of a philosophy for gentlemen. Women didn't count. Of gentlemen of the establishment, who were bound to rule, who had authority, who should order their people, their society, in the same way that God had ordered his universe. This is the division. Now, obviously, we associate wisdom with the court. It's not a matter of chance that King Solomon was assumed to have the wisdom of the world, to know 1,001 parables, to be able to speak the languages of the birds, that he was known as the ultimate wise man, and that the book of Proverbs was assigned to him by the tradition. Tradition also assigns part of the book of Proverbs to the court of King Hezekiah, a 7th century king of Judah. It was to the court that the wise men were brought, the Merlins of the day, the Benjamin Franklins of the day. And there their wisdom was prized because being good wisdom, it had to lead to good policy. Good wisdom has to lead to meaningful consequence. Now let me try and look at wisdom from another point of view, how it begins and what it develops into. In the first instance, wisdom is what? It's simply the assumptions of men of what we know, folk wisdom. And the Bible, in this sense, is full of folk wisdom. Better a live dog than a dead lion. The crooked cannot be made straight. And we have a number of texts in the Bible in which the prophets or others take a bit of folk wisdom and turn it around. Say it's not really wisdom, there's a deeper sense, there's a deeper meaning. There was an old proverb, a proverb which I still hear vibrations of today. The fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. Which is very, in its positive modern version, you know, the apple never falls far from the tree. The children are assumed to be what the parents make them into. The prophet Jeremiah took this old proverb and turned it around, and the text comes out this way. In those days, that is, in the better times, they shall no more say, the fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. And for every one shall die for his own sin. Every man that eats the sour grapes, his teeth, and his teeth only, shall be set on edge. It's obviously an attack on clan justice. It's an attack on the assumption that what the adult leader of the clan does ultimately determines the moral success, the innocence or guilt of all adult members of that clan. It's the beginning of our modern judicial sense of individual responsibility. No one should stand in judgment in place of another man. All men must take their own deserts for what they are. So part of the origin of wisdom goes back to folk wisdom. Part of it goes back to technical wisdom. That is, to the knowledge of irrigation systems, of the weather, of the meaning of the tides, of farming procedures. And again, we have some of this illustrated in the Bible. I don't know if anybody here is a good farmer. I've got a terribly black thumb. But in the 28th chapter of Isaiah, we've got a bit of old farmer's wisdom. If somebody wants to interpret it for me afterwards, they may. I'll simply read it to you. Listen and hear what I say. Attend and hear my words. Will the plowman continually plow for the sowing, breaking his ground and harrowing it? Does he not, once he has leveled it, broadcast the dill and scatter the cumin? Does he not plant the wheat in rows with barley and spelt along the edge? Does not his God instruct him and train him aright? Dill is not threshed with a sledge. The cartwheel is not rolled over the cumin. Dill is beaten with a rod and cumin with a flail. Corn is crushed, but not to the uttermost, not with a final crushing. The farmer's cartwheels rumble over it and break it up, but they do not grind it fine. This message, too, comes from the Lord of hosts, whose purposes are wonderful and his powers great. Now, if you're a farmer, 8th century Palestine, that's a very helpful kind of bit of advice, how to handle corn, what to plant in the center of the field, what kind of windbreak to plant around your field, what grain you're to thresh completely, and what you're only to break the skin to allow the grain to come out. Now, what I can't give to you in the translation is the sense, the poetic sense in which all this is phrased. All this is phrased in poetry, in a highly onomatopoetic language, where there's resonance, it's easy to remember, and it's put in this form so that it can be put from farmer to son to grandson, you know, passed on down as the wisdom of the people. Now, a third kind of primitive wisdom is the riddle. Remember Seder night, we play the game with our children, who knows one, and everybody knows one. One is the God of the world. And when I get them to 13 and I say, now who knows 13, I'm met with abject silence. You know 13?
Yeah, 13.
12?
5.
11? Stars in Joseph's dream? 10? Good. 9? What? So 9 months of childbirth. 8? It could be, but it's 8 lights of Hanukkah. 7 days of the week. 6? 6 days of creation, or 6 orders of the Mishnah. 5? Books of Moses. 4? Name them. Leah. 3? Patriarchs. 2 tables of the covenant and 1 God of the world. Now, I did that way because that's exactly what these riddles were used for. They're used as teaching devices, as aids to memory. If we remember 13 something or others, we'll remember if there were 13 attributes, and then if I press a little further, we might even be able to come up with Eorachum v'chanu, Nerach ha'payim v'rav chesed, the text itself on which the 13 is numbered out. And all through the literature, you'll find in one form or another these games with numbers. The book of Proverbs is filled with them. For instance, let me ask you a question. Let's see what we can come up with. What 4 things are never satisfied? What would you say? What 4 things are never satisfied? Henry?
The eye
is never satisfied with seeing. Well, that's a good answer. What else could it be? Oh, I know a lot of minds that know all the answers. They've long since been satisfied.
Appetite.
Appetites? Yeah, I guess we could say appetites are never satisfied. basically say is never satisfied in this life. A man's ego.
Greed.
All these are good answers. You know, you can preach a lot of wonderful sermons on the answers. The traditional answer in the book of Proverbs are the following. Are the four things that are never satisfied. The grave. The barren womb. The earth with water. And a fire. I think yours are better. But these are very suggestive. Another one. What four things are incredibly wonderful? What four things are incredibly wonderful? Sunrise, you say?
Life.
All right. A sunrise. What, bud? Darkness. Creation, that's life. And she's not even here. What are you doing out here? Well, the traditional answers, the way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on the rock, the way of a ship at sea, and the way of two young lovers. Now, all of this is the root of wisdom. Wisdom grows, in other words, from the ordinary activity of the mind in any kind of social order, the ordinary ways of teaching. But it becomes something more. It becomes that which moves a society from knowledge to wisdom. That is, that which takes facts or information and gives them life, gives them depth, gives them substantiality, makes them feel real and valid and eternal and necessary. Wisdom is the substance of what the teachers of ancient peoples taught. Now, the academic is not a prophet. That is, he's never not as filled with moral outrage as the prophets are. He makes do. He learns to live in the imperfect world. And there's a great deal of very pragmatic, prudential, cautious advice in the books of the prophet, of Proverbs. Don't get too close to rule, to authority, because they'll snap off your head. You can't trust the king always to be well-intentioned towards you. He's fickle, just as any other human being. The assumptions are the assumptions of a settled order. That is, there's no attempt to reconstruct the social order. They wouldn't have thought in those terms in any way in those days, because that was beyond human capacity. But they're really telling us how to make do in the world as we find it. But more, not so much to make do, because that has a kind of connotation of shrewdness. They're telling us how to live with a certain amount of becoming grace, so that whatever happens to us in this world will be for such good as we can find in this world. The wisdom literature of the ancient Near East really ends up in the Stoic tradition of the Greeks. Zeno, the founder of the Stoics, was an Asian. He wasn't an Athenian. He was born in Anatolia. And he really synthesizes in his teachings a great deal of what had been taught for centuries before him by the wise men of the Middle East, which is essentially that life is a relatively cruel, confusing place, but there is a good way to live. And if you live that way, nothing that's too bad can happen to you. Don't care too much for things. Don't care too much for status. Don't care too much for love. All these things can be taken from you. Don't deny them necessarily, but don't invest too much in them. Don't invest yourself in them to the point where you can be destroyed emotionally if they're taken away from you. Learn to live with balance. Learn to live with a certain degree of emotional detachment. Learn to live with a very high degree of discipline. The word chacham suggests simply wisdom, but the synonym for chacham is musar. And the Hebrew word musar means discipline. And they talk of a very strict kind of emotional and personal discipline in dress, in manners, in act, and in feeling. It's a holding yourself back And somebody wrote a book recently about the Jews as the passionate people. These old teachers would have been askance. The last thing they wanted was for people to be impassioned. That was folly. Too dangerous in the world as they knew it. And so the kind of wisdom that you find is prudential. Let me read some of it to you. This is one of the chapters in the book of Proverbs. It probably goes back to the 8th, 9th pre-Christian centuries, probably pre-exilic. It's a series of couplets, proverbial couplets. Better be poor and above reproach than rich and crooked in speech. Desire without knowledge is not good. I was saying about passion. The man in a hurry misses the way. What I was saying about prudence. A man's own folly wrecks his life, and then he bears a grudge against God. Wealth makes many friends, but a man without means loses the friends he has. If you think of the courts of the ancient world, the minute the king couldn't supply his courtiers went someplace else. Many curry favor with the great. A lavish giver has the world for his friend. Practice in evil makes the perfect scoundrel. The man who talks too much meets his own deserts. To learn sense is true self-love. Cherish discernment and make sure of success. A fool at the helm is out of place. How much worse a slave in command of men of rank. To be patient shows intelligence. To overlook faults is a man's glory. A king's rage is like a lion's roar. His favor is like dew on the grass and just as evanescent. A stupid son is a calamity to his father. A nagging wife is like water, dripping endlessly. The Chinese water torture. Home and wealth may come down from ancestors, but an intelligent wife is a gift from God. Laziness is the undoing of the worthless. Idlers must starve. To keep the commandments keeps a man safe, but scorning the way of the Lord brings death. He who is generous to the poor lends to the Lord. He will repay him in full measure. Chastise your son while there is still hope for him, but be careful not to flog him to death. Different world than ours. A man's ill temper brings its own punishment. Try to save him, and you make matters worse. Listen to advice and accept instruction, and you will die a wise man. A man's heart may be full of schemes, but the Lord's purpose will prevail. The fear of the Lord is life. He who is full of it will not rest untouched by evil. Now, there's wisdom here, and there's something that's short of wisdom. The reach isn't very far. You're not going to get a better society by following this kind of advice. And you're never going to know the thrill of a love that knocks you for a loop by following this kind of advice. But in a confusing world, in the kind of very limited world that was that world, where the lifespan was probably 25 or 26 years, where you didn't have much of a chance to recoup from your mistakes, where 2% of the population was literate and had some opportunity, the rest were serfs and slaves and beaten every day to their work, where the fall from the establishment to poverty was a fall from being a human being to being a human animal, a workhorse. This kind of wisdom was obviously a very urgently needed kind of thing, and the long life and the geographic spread of this kind of wisdom testifies to its importance. But, and I think this is the important thing, ancient Israel was not satisfied with this kind of providential wisdom, with this kind of prudential wisdom, rather, with the book of Proverbs. The book book of Proverbs is probably the most uninspired book of the Bible. It's the most practical. It's the one you can read with the best advantage sometimes, but it's the most uninspired book of the Bible. And our people did something very interesting with wisdom. They took wisdom, that is the Proverbs, and they began to look at them. And they began to examine them. And to do this with them, you know, the old Jewish way. And they began to wonder whether, in fact, these proverbs, where there is something that if you do good, good must come to you, and good must come to the community, there's a good way which will never fail. If these assumptions, in fact, held true. Our people have been the most skeptical people of faith that this world has ever created. It's a fascinating fact. The book of Job is wisdom. The book of Ecclesiastes is wisdom. That is, it is wisdom literature written by wise men, about wise men, using many of the proverbs which were familiar. The book of Job you know well, so let me talk of the book of Ecclesiastes. And the book of Ecclesiastes allows me to do something else. Because the author of Ecclesiastes deliberately used a series of proverbs which he peppers throughout the book. And somehow when he uses them, they turn his hand to something very, very different. The book of Ecclesiastes begins, you know, vanity of vanity, always vanity, saith the Lord. And it ends, remember that created in the days of thy youth before the evil days come when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. The book of Ecclesiastes has absolutely nothing good to say about life. It doesn't commend the vigorous life. It's certainly not a prophetic book filled with moral outrage, you know, go out and do something about the world. A tired book. It is a book of a man who has examined all the solid, good, righteous assumptions of religion in his day and found that he's a little bit skeptical about the whole lot of them. Now, what's life? Is it time to be born? Is it time to die? Is it time to laugh? Is it time to cry? Is it time to pick up stones? Is it time to tear down stones? Life is an endless, pointless cycle, a drudgery. The sea, the rivers pour to the sea, but the sea is never filled. The sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and the next morning it comes up again. There's an endless, repetitive cycle. There's no such thing as movement, progress, change for the better. Now, he rolls this kind of dispirited philosophy around a series of very solid, self-righteous proverbs. One chapter which I chose out for tonight has the following proverbs in them. These are all proverbs we can attest to from other wisdom literature. The fool holds his hands and wastes away. We have a thousand fables and stories to illustrate that truth. Again, better one hand full and peace of mind than both fists full and toil that is a chasing after the wind. Again, good bit of proverbial wisdom. Two are better than one. They receive a good reward for their toil. If one falls, the other can help his companion up again. There are a young man poor and wise and a king old and foolish. Now that's proverb. Old cliche. Proverbial wisdom. But listen how the whole thing comes out. What a wise man does as the tradition, as he debates with himself or with his class, with his philosophy, the meaning of life. Again, I considered all the acts of oppression here under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and I saw that there was no one to comfort them. Strength was on the side of their oppressors, and there was no one to avenge them. I counted the dead happy because they were dead. Happier than living, who are still in life. More fortunate than either, I reckon the man yet unborn, who had not witnessed the wicked deeds done here under the sun. I considered all toil and all achievements, and saw that it comes from rivalry between man and man. This too is emptiness, and chasing the wind. The fool folds his arms and wastes away, but at one hand full, peace of mind, both fists full, and toil is chasing the wind. Here again I saw emptiness under the sun. A lonely man without a friend, without son or brother, toiling endlessly, yet never satisfied with his wealth. For whom, he asks, am I working and denying myself the good things of life? This too is emptiness, a sorry business. two are better than one. They receive a good reward for their trouble because if one falls, the other can help his companion up again. But alas, for the man who falls alone with no partner to help him up. And if two lie side by side, they keep each other warm.
But how can one keep warm whose masters he became? And he in turn will be no hero to those who come after him. This too is emptiness and a chasing after the wind. The wisdom literature of the Bible raises more stringently, more carefully, more systematically the basic logical problem of the Jewish faith than any other literature that we have. And it's important primarily because of that. Biblical Judaism, as I've said to you again and again, assumes a covenant between God and man. And this covenant is Sinai. It is the stipulations, thou shalt and thou shalt not, what you shall do and what you shall not do. But it's more than a set of regulations. It is the further statement, if you obey, it will be well with you. If you do not obey, things will go badly with you. It's a court system. God is the judge. And insofar as you obey the law, you are rewarded. Insofar as you disobey the law, you must accept the punishment. And all the biblical faith has this kind of classroom or courtroom ring to it. Now you get Job. Now you get Ecclesiastes. And there's other material in the wisdom literature which challenges this whole assumption. It is simply not true in the world as we know it that the good are always rewarded and the wicked people are always punished. There's the man who is a slave who becomes king. There's the fool who rules. There's the lonely man who's worked hard and he has no joy from what he does. Or in our terms, there's the child who's born mongoloid or retarded or stillborn. There's the youngster who dies of leukemia. There are all kinds of injustices in the world as we know it. And the wisdom literature raises this whole question of theodicy, of God's providence, and has forced the Jew ever since to recognize that it is precisely at this point that he must make his leap of faith. The question is never, is there a God or isn't there a God? That's a relatively immaterial question. The question is the world organized purposively or is it not organized purposely? Is there meaning to what we do or is there what we do ultimately without meaning? Is life absurd as some theater would have it today or does it have meaning? And ultimately we've got to make a leap beyond reason, beyond logic, from where we are to the assumption that there is purpose and there is reason to do good. Now, some will say, I will be rewarded for doing the good. And some will say, I must do it even if I am not rewarded. But the leap has to be made. And wisdom, the wisdom literature, more than any other literature, forced the Jew to recognize and to thereby to deepen his faith, to recognize that this nice, literal, little world, which he had assumed, which is like the classroom. You study, you do your homework, you'll get a star on the blackboard. You don't study, you don't do your homework, mother will get a deficiency slip. That this little world is not the real world. And there is no justice in that sense in the real world. And how do we live in the real world doing what we think is just and is necessary? If Judaism had not had the wisdom literature and been forced to contemplate these problems, we wouldn't have survived the persecutions. We couldn't answer the question of Hitler, the Holocaust. Why? I don't know that we still can answer it. But I know we've spent 2,500 years since the wisdom literature, trying to come to grips with it. And we can thank that literature, at least, for having raised the problem. So that's my conventional and unconventional wisdom. And now is your time to ask me the conventional and unconventional questions, and I'll try and deal with them as best I can. What were some of the bases in which some of the books were included in the Bible and others rejected? We haven't got the faintest idea. We don't know. If I did know, I could write a book and win the Nobel Prize for doing it. There isn't a single bit of literary evidence of why books were included and books not. It's all conjecture. What seems to have happened simply is that certain books had authority associated with them and certain did not, and the few at the tail end didn't have enough authority to come in precisely. Now, we know which ones almost didn't make it. There were four. Esther, probably because God has never mentioned the book of Esther. The Song of Songs, because obviously love poetry. Proverbs, because some of the things I've suggested tonight. And Ecclesiastes, for the reasons I've suggested tonight. But that's only suggestions.
On a comparative basis, are there other religions which have this kind of fatalistic, non-rewarding aspect?
Yes, there is literature from both Babylon and Egypt, which raises this whole question of theodicy. Not as clearly, not as sharply as the biblical literature, but there are parallels to it. It was a problem which the whole Middle East was bothered by. And it's the real basis of doubt, of religious doubt for that part of the world. I can't quote you this literature, but it is there. And if you want to look it up, there's a book called Pritchard's Ancient Middle Eastern Texts. Look under the question of theodicy. There's a story of the three brothers. There are a few other stories of this kind which raise the question. There must have been a real challenge raised by this, not by the text so much, but by the problems they raised, because the Talmud, as you know, defines atheism as a statement, late din v'late dayan. There is no judge and there's no justice. That was, to the rabbinic Jew, the definition of disbelief. And obviously this was where the issues were. And you can see it, you know, throughout this whole world. Why does Zoroastrianism suddenly emerge as a dominant faith? Because it had an answer to the problem of evil. There was a good God and there was an evil God. There were these juxtaposed forces of black and white, day and night, Ahriman and Ahura Mazda. And you could understand the existence of evil. You had an answer for what it was worth. Our answer was difficult, because if you assume that God is good, how does evil come into being? Either a good God has created evil, or there's no such thing as evil, the Christian Science position, or what is evil is only seemingly so, which is what the rabbis tended to say. Suffering is often good for us. Yisurin shalahava, the suffering that God inflicts upon us because of his love for us. But somehow Job never allows you to be satisfied with that. You've got to press further. The Christian tradition took it to the point where they really personified, they're really a Zoroastrian answer. They personified evil and Satan, the devil. And Judaism would not go that far, which is not to say we didn't have the Sitra Achra, we didn't have images of some almost satanic power. But ultimately, the Jew looked for the good in the bad. And so when he defined the human soul, he said man's soul is made up of two instincts, the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer Hara, a loving, charitable, generous, empathetic spirit, and a driving, aggressive, more violent kind of spirit. But were it not for the so-called evil spirit, cities wouldn't be built, businesses wouldn't be established, families wouldn't be provided for, marriages wouldn't take place. Now, he found in the aggressive pressures within the human soul some good. And this monistic way of looking at human personality, at looking at the world, is a traditional Jewish way. It doesn't fit all the requirements of logical analysis, because everything doesn't fit within it. But it is the way Jews have always done it.
If God says, Noah, Yitzhak Ra,
Jerry says that the inclinations of man's heart are evil from their midst. You can find all kinds of quotations. Yeah, but it's a question of what the tradition does with it. Judaism did not find man to be evil. And therefore, man didn't need to be kept in abject submission to some divine authority. Man was created in the image of God. And the image of God was defined as his soul. And his soul, therefore, had something divine in it, and it had something that was aggressive in it. And that's what became normative.
Both times, the time of Genesis, God speaks of man totally evil, all the time.
Not quite.
Well, that's what he said.
And God saw what he had done, and behold, it was good. God created man in his own image, the image of man, the image God created he him.
Last statement gets rid of everything he said.
No. These are different texts. And you have it, Sam, you know, if you want to play the game of text, what you have essentially here is a set of documents coming from various periods of time, and yes, there is a common assumption in that kind of world that man is abject, and Judaism outgrew it. What is man that thou art mindful, and the son of man that thou art mindful, and yet thou hast made him but little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and with honor. All you're saying, Sam, with all due love, is that you read a couple of very unhappy newsletters before you came in here, and your tendency is to be cynical about man anyway, so you're down on him, and you want to find the Bible what you want to find in it. You can do it. I can't stop you. But that's not the way the Bible is. There is a line in Genesis which says, the inclinations of a man's heart are evil from his youth. There's another one that says, sin crouches at the door. There are a few texts which seem to be the texts which suggest that you and I are irremediably evil. He certainly suggested it to some of the monastics of the apocalyptic period out of which Christianity grew, because what gift does Christ bring into the world if it's not to redeem man from this kind of original sinfulness? Well, Janet, you're talking now like the doctor. And could be, but I doubt it. I doubt it because we can find similarities to this literature right through the Middle East. Is there a place in Judaism for existentialist thinking? I've yet to discover a kind of thinking that there really isn't a place for in Judaism. We were remarkably broad-mindedness. If by existentialism you mean, well, let's define terms. If you mean the assumption that what is critical is the moment, and that it is in the moment that somehow all meaning is to be found, that what is past is dead and what is ahead is as yet unknown, and all we have is the immediate moment. But what do you mean then? Well, that's not existentialism. That's simply, any kind of humanist philosophy assumes that. Existentialism starts with the word itself, existence, moment. And it is the assumption that all that has been before has meaning only if it has meaning to us at the moment. You know, all the Chinese who've ever lived in China have no meaning to what's been going on in this room at the moment. We are a product of given cultures, and we've filtered out only that part of those given cultures which have any meaning to us, and only those things which are right here and now are consequential. Now, that doesn't mean you deny learning. It's simply you deny the authority of traditions because you say the tradition. I am the filter of the tradition. History begins with me. Oh, it could be, but what you said is much broader.
Yeah.
You're saying essentially that I'm going to make up my own mind. In my sense, Martin Buber is an existentialist. Franz Rosenzweig is an existentialist. Bernie Martin wrote a book called Three Jewish Existentialist Philosophers, so obviously we can have existentialist Jewish philosophers. Well, yes. A, he's a Christian, a believing Christian. B, the leap of faith he takes, therefore, is conditioned by the environment he comes from. C, he talks in terms of absolutes. And that's where he really falls away from Judaism. Kierkegaard wrote a book called Either Or. You either are in this world or you're out of it. You're either in the trammels of life as it is, or you've freed yourself from it. It's the old dualism, body and soul, the worldly and the spiritual, religion and the secular order. Now, Judaism has almost none of that in its tradition. And what we've tended to work with is this, both and. Instead of the absolutes between which you must choose, you have something in tension, and the truth lies someplace in between. And that's why rabbis always have answers. But it's more than that. It's why in Judaism you don't have a division between the religious and the secular. Your home is not secular in the sense that what happens here is religious and what happens in your home is secular. Jewish law embraced all of life. And in Judaism, to have a religion which didn't include all that we call civilization would be a meaningless kind of thing. It's always both and, not sort of either or. Not, I'm either going to be completely in this world or I'm going to go completely out of this world. It's, I'm going to be in this world, I'm also going to have my privacy. I'm not going to either say I must either live a life completely alone and never marry, or I must marry and never divorce my wife, but I will live for myself when I need to, with my wife, and if need be, I will divorce, or she will divorce me. The absolutes are not the ways in which we've tended to think. So if you read the Jewish existentialists, you'll find them very different from Kierkegaard. They talk of the moment, the meeting, revelation being in the meeting, but they do not talk about having to go one way or the other completely.
What about the modern Jew? How does he look upon
I've never known how to answer a question, you know, how does the modern Jews think about something, because there are as many answers as there are modern Jews. The problem of suffering is the critical problem of Jewish faith today. Because for the last 50 years, the Jews have suffered in an incredible kind of way. It isn't simply that, you know, poverty or the ghetto. It's life and death. And I've been intrigued by something. There was much more violent atheism among Jews 50 years ago than after Hitler. The Jews brought atheism as part of the socialist baggage they brought out of Eastern Europe, this anger with the religious structure, because they were angry at the Russian Orthodox Church and the Tsar and all of that, and they transferred it to the synagogue. But somehow you didn't have that in 45, 46, 47 when the death camps opened. When the, and I don't know why. I mean, it's almost unreasonable. But the survivors were not in that sense angry with God. They were often angry with men of goodwill who hadn't done anything to save them, but they weren't angry with God. And insofar as I've been able to, you know, how do Jews react, that's about the only answer I can give you. It's not a logical answer, but it's a kind of emotional answer. It's also true that the Jewish answer has been in terms of a determination not to give, sort of, to use Falkenhayn's phrase, not to give Hitler his posthumous victory. In other words, to do everything to make Jewish life survive, because by God, if it didn't, Hitler would have won. And this is a life-affirming kind of commandment, in a very interesting and basic kind of way. Interestingly, there's, you know, after the Second World War, we had the so-called religious revival here in America. We had the great JDC experience. We had the pioneering work in Israel. We had a real affirmation of life and of possibility, rather than the turning away and the embittering that you would have assumed. So that's about the only answer I can give you.
Is there growth through pain?
Is there growth through pain? Sometimes there is, and sometimes there isn't. You give a person enough pain, and you'll brutalize them. There are people who are grasshopper people who become human through pain. There are people who are grasshopper people who simply fall into self-pity when anything painful happens to them. I don't think you can generalize. It all depends on the human condition, the human stuff that's there to start off with. But I certainly have not found any kind of a rule that fits. I've seen, about all I've learned about pain is a very frightening thing. And that people who've been in terrible pain are scared stiff of it. They're scared stiff more of pain than death sometimes.
When did the concept of absence be reward punishment after death have an analogy here?
Just about the time it appears in Jewish thought or in general? Jewish thought appears just about the time of the wisdom literature, the late wisdom literature. The Bible has a kind of shadowy afterlife in a place called Sheol, where the spirits live on in some kind of vague statement. There's no reward or punishment associated with it whatsoever. It's kind of it explains ghosts in the sense of that you get in dreams, that you revisited by your parents and grandparents, necromancy, all of that. But in the book of Daniel, you get a direct reference to afterlife, the dead living on. And then in Greek times, Hellenistic times, this idea becomes a prominent one. It's obviously a very convenient answer, among other things, to the question of why is this world so not non-just. And you'll find all kinds of statements that God tries us here so that we can be purged of our few sins here and we'll be able to move into paradise directly. To this day, the Orthodox Jew will say Kaddish for his parents only for 11 months, lest the assumption be that he has to say all 12 months to get their soul out of purgatory and into heaven. Because 12 months is the full probationary period, according to the old legend. Rabbinic Judaism made a great deal of it. And it becomes a kind of basic thing. But here, too, we stopped short. We never had Dante's Inferno. We never, had the literature which picked out your favorite victims and described the tortures and the damns that they would be exposed to, and then there's no sadistic pleasure. What God will do after this world, it's up to him. And Judaism spends remarkably little time describing hell. It's remarkable when you think of heaven. They spend a good bit of time, particularly under Arab influence. The Arabs love to describe heaven. The Jews picked it up. But hell, very little. It's there. I mean, there is punishment. But they don't describe it. They don't spend much time on it.
Yeah, Nathan gets that. A great deal of that.
The Garden of Eden. Oh, yeah. The Huris and the... Oh, sure. One of the problems of biblical philosophy is that the Bible tends to assume that there's a great consequence for your children in what you do and the way you live. The old proverb was, if a father eats sour grapes, his children's teeth are set on edge. The sins of the fathers live on to the third and fourth generation. They say the good goes on to the 100th generation, but it's still what you are. What are they saying? They're responding a little bit to the evidence of what happened to a clan which was mismanaged. It became ragtag, impoverished. Ultimately was destroyed. They had a certain, I'm sure, medical knowledge in this, of how some of these diseases are genetically transmitted, especially some of the venereal diseases in that part of the world. They're talking about the importance of, in small societies, of a family name, a good name, respect, honor. All that this implies, and they were responding really to a kind of common sense observation that if your father was known as a no good bum, it's going to be tougher for you. since your father was known as a wise man in the wisdom sense. What they fought out of was not so much the ethical statement as the legal statement. You see, in the old legal systems of the ancient Middle East, a number of things which we would think of fundamentally unjust, in fact, took place. If we were two clans in this room, and Sam one day, in one of his more misogynist moods, decided to take off at Henry over here and did him bodily harm, anybody on this side of the room could attack anybody in Sam's clan and do him similar bodily harm. There was no police court, there was no system of trial. It was simply a kind of Cold War confrontation, you know, that if you hit me, I'm going to hit you back. And then they went beyond that. As they began to develop a primitive legal system, the head of the clan could say, all right, I did wrong, but I'm needed to run my clan, and I'm going to send Saul out to stand punishment for me. So Saul is put on trial rather than Sam. Well, it's a kind of surrogate which says something about what's urgently required in order for a clan to survive, the authority of the clan head. And what they're fighting hard to do is to avoid this surrogate kind of punishment, which was not that Saul would be sent out probably, but Sam would send out one of his slaves to take the punishment. And because all that was some dollars out of his pocket, that slave wasn't a human being in those terms. And they're fighting hard to come to as they did come by the middle of the biblical period, to a legal concept where each man must stand trial for his own mistakes, for his own crimes. And that's a remarkable breakthrough in the development of law. And it comes just about in the middle of the biblical development. We don't know. There is a story in the Book of Kings that when the temple was being refurbished or something was being done to it, the end of the 7th century, in 621 before the Common Era, the workmen found a scroll of the law underneath some stone someplace, or in a treasury someplace. And they took it to a prophet, a woman by the name of Huldah, and Huldah confirmed that this was, in fact, Torah, revealed word, and it was proclaimed as such. Now, the incident probably took place. Whether or not this incident suggests that this was, whether or not this suggests it was the book of Deuteronomy or not, we don't know. We do know that, or scholars do tell us, that the basic text of Deuteronomy includes much material which is very old, and much material which is reworked according to the prophetic understanding of the Jewish tradition in the 8th or 7th or 6th pre-Christian century. It certainly, in my opinion, was in being in about its present form before the exile. Whether it is that scroll or not, that's another question. But it is,
by the time that Ezra comes back after the exile, It's certainly known as Torah, and I'm sure it existed before. It is not a Babylonian piece, in other words. Anything else before we break for much-needed coffee on a cold night? Again, my thanks to all of you for coming out on a night like this. I think that's a tribute beyond anything I know to Jewish learning. And this ends our fall semester, most of which has been my responsibility. We're going to, as you remember, we're going to take the 3 Mondays of January in consecutive Mondays for our intercession. And we're going to do 3 illustrated lectures. They're sort of out of sequence with the readings in the book. One on the songs, development of our own religious music. One on the sanctuaries, which I'm going to do. It's some slides I have which are going to show you what the shrines look like, what the temple look like, what synagogues look like, and why, all during our history. And finally, one on the symbols, the basic symbols, what they are, and when they came into being, and what they represent. And Dr. Gutmann of Wayne State is coming in to do that for us. That'll be fun. And then we'll get the spring semester, which is largely Dr. Martin's responsibility, and I'll sit back with you and enjoy it. Let's have some coffee.